The Prabhupad Ki. Hare Krishna. Okay. Let me just turn my mic off. I'm in my recorder on here. Good. So this morning, we I gave the introduction to a seminar that I've been expounding around the world for the last few years, called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. For those of you that weren't here this morning, we covered the introduction, and it's a look at Srila Prabhupada's activities, his teachings, his interactions with his disciples, and an insider's look, if you like, in one sense, of what it was like to be with Srila Prabhupada, traveling with him, and the things that were going on in his rooms as well as in public. And essentially, it's to give us a deeper understanding of what it means to be a devotee of Krishna. So I mentioned that I had divided things up into different categories or themes: chanting, prasadam, books, health, cleanliness, association. There's different topics, and whatever Prabhupada said or did on that particular topic, I've tried to compile that into some kind of order. I did mention this morning that I was going to invite everybody to vote on which particular topic they'd like me to speak on this afternoon. We can do that, or I can just pick a topic and we can talk. What would you prefer? Shall I choose or will you choose? All right, makes it easier. We don't have to count all the hands then. That's all right, so I thought that since the essence of this movement is chanting, we could take a look at that topic. It's quite a big one. It actually, if I'm speaking in English, it usually takes me about 14 hours to get through the whole seminar. So we're only going to get a little glimpse this afternoon. I believe that on the following couple of evenings, Monday and Tuesday at least, we'll be continuing with this seminar. So if you're able to get over, you can catch up. Otherwise, if you want to get the entire seminar, it's available on my website. You can download all the different segments. The website is called lotusimprints.com, lotusimprints.com, or you can just type harrysori.com and it will take you to the same website. So they're there. Okay, so anyway, today, this afternoon, we've got two segments. I'll spend about 45 minutes on this seminar, and then we're going to have another 40-minute presentation, PowerPoint presentation, about the Bhaktivedanta Archives, which is our place in North Carolina in America, where we've been collecting all of the original manuscripts and artifacts of Srila Prabhupada, all of his teachings, all of the recordings, over 100,000 slides and photographs, 130,000 slides and photographs, etc. It's an archive, but it's particularly just for Srila Prabhupada's works. So we'll have a look at that activity after this seminar. Okay, so chanting Hare Krishna, that's the Yuga Dharma, but not many people actually knew that, even here in India. Of course, 500 years ago, Lord Chaitanya, he came to inaugurate the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, particularly as the means for salvation or liberation, going back home, back to Godhead. Then for some hundreds of years, of course, it was a little localized. The teachings and awareness of Lord Chaitanya was kind of confined mainly to Bengal and a bit of Orissa, but largely kind of disappeared. Of course, on this side of the country, you had saints like Tukaram, who was inspired by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and had kirtan, sankirtan activity going on. But by and large, by the 19th century, it had become diminished, the importance of it. The philosophy was sadly distorted in many different ways by various groups. And it wasn't really till the advent of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur that Vaishnavism was brought back to preeminence. The real meaning of the philosophy, the real practices of Krishna consciousness, they were revived in large part by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he also began the effort to preach in what had become a worldwide language, English, due to the British Empire spreading all over, here and there and everywhere. But one good thing that they did was that they taught everybody their language, so there was a common means of communication all around the world. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very quick to pick up on that. In 1896, he sent a small book, The Life and Precepts of Lord Chaitanya, to many universities in the Western countries. One of them was in Sydney. We found an original copy of that book in the Rare Books Library in Sydney University in the late 1970s. That's in the archives now. Don't tell anybody, though. We didn't buy it from them. But we have that book, and Prabhupada noted that it is not a coincidence that he was born the same year that that book was sent out by Thakur Bhaktivinoda to the Western countries. And the prediction that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had made, when will that day come when the fortunate Americans, Europeans, Russians will gather in Mayapur and chant with joy, Jai Satchinandana, Jai Satchinandana, Hare Krishna, like this. So he predicted that very shortly a personality will come who will fulfill the desire of Lord Chaitanya, Prativichaya Chajato Nagaradi Gram, Sabrachar Prachar Hoyabai Murnam. That will become fulfilled. So more on that in a second. So of course, his son, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, made tremendous efforts to begin the fulfillment of that prediction. He sent some of his disciples overseas in the 1930s to England to try to establish some, what they call a beachhead of Krishna consciousness in the Malacha Desh. He also sent some disciples to places like Burma, where they had some center in Rangoon there. So he was trying. But somehow or another, it didn't manifest until, of course, 1965, when Srila Prabhupada sailed away on the Jaladuta on Friday the 13th. Yeah, he actually sailed on Friday the 13th. And landed on the shores of America, and the rest, as they say, is history. And we're all part of it, fortunately. So that effort of Srila Prabhupada is kind of unrepeatable. There's always a thing that no matter who comes afterwards, but whoever does something first, nobody can repeat that. There's always a unique factor, you know. Somebody is the first one to do something. Even if somebody comes along later on and does the same thing on a bigger scale or, you know, more refined or whatever, still the unique position is held by the person who began it. So that's Srila Prabhupada. He's the unique acharya in our line. Somebody once asked in Nellore, there was some, Prabhupada was in Nellore from January the 3rd to about January the 8th in 1976, Nellore in South India. There were some newspaper reports. Some of our devotees had had a little conflict with the authorities in Japan. whilst they were out selling books and collecting funds for our Mayapur Center. So it was in the newspapers. Some criticism was there. Some big guru in South India had read that in the newspapers and saw in his Janmashtami program he had been speaking against the ISKCON devotees. Just see, they're all black sheep, he was saying. These are not Hindus. They're all black sheep causing so many problems like that. Why are they doing these things? Why are they, you know, going to these foreign cities and chanting Hare Krishna like that? If Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted his movement to go all over the world, why didn't he do it himself? Good question. And so we were on a morning walk. This was being relayed to Srila Prabhupada by one of his disciples and by one gentleman that had been there at that meeting when this man made this statement. And so one of the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada that, well, they say if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted to do it himself, I mean, if he wanted it to go around the world, why didn't he do it himself? So then Prabhupada smiled. He said, because he left it to me to do. Yeah. So that was Prabhupada's unique position. After 500 years, it came to him to fulfill that prediction, to take the chanting of Hare Krishna all around the world. And he did it. So nobody else can repeat that. That's it. Whoever comes afterwards, they're simply eating the prasadam of Srila Prabhupada. That's all. So Prabhupada's position then is very unique for many different reasons. Of course, he did say that his books would form the basis for law and order for the next 10,000 years. So that's another important feature. But let's look at the chanting. So anyway, not everybody was appreciating what Srila Prabhupada was doing in the 1970s in creating temples, installing deities, chanting Hare Krishna, you know, in so many different places around the world. And surprisingly enough, even some of his own godbrothers were not very appreciative of that. But there were a couple of godbrothers that really understood what Prabhupada was doing and really praised him for it. One of them was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji. He was a very wonderful godbrother of Srila Prabhupada's. There's an interesting story. I don't know how accurate this is, but I think the essence of it is true, that when he first joined the Gaudiya Math in Calcutta at their temple at Ultadanga there, he walked in, he sat down, and he started chanting. And he was chanting and chanting and chanting. And of course, they had this ethic, because they asked all of their, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta asked all of his disciples, you should chant 64 rounds. But if somebody couldn't do that, they had to make up for that by doing service throughout the day. And if they were, you know, continually engaged in service, then they could do less. So at one point they asked this new man, now please come and do this service, do this. But he just kept on chanting. And he wouldn't do anything else. He just wanted to chant. So after a few days, apparently, they approached Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and said, this man is here and all he does is chant. He says that's all he wants to do. Of course, sometimes you get people like that. They come in and, no, I'm chanting. No, I can't clean this. I can't cook that. I can't do this. I'm chanting. But it's just actually an excuse so that they don't have to do any work. Yeah. But this, so they were thinking maybe this man's the same. You know, he's just off the street, whatever. Anyway, so Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati apparently said, all right, you just sit with him and you chant with him. Yeah? So they did that, and they were chanting, and he was chanting, and then they were chanting, and he was chanting, and then after some time, they couldn't chant anymore. But he kept on chanting. And he was chanting and chanting. So in that way, then Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, yes, so let him chant. So that was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji. He was well known in the Gaudiya Math. That's what he did. He chanted Hare Krishna. And I believe I heard that when Prabhupada took sannyas, then the next morning he took hold of Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji and he said, come on, let's go out and preach. So right from the first day, and he took him with him. So they were old friends. Whenever Prabhupada came to Vrindavan, generally, Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji would come and see him. He was in such a state of consciousness, he used to be very bright-faced all the time. He was always laughing, always. And he was always chanting. So even when you were having a conversation with him, as soon as he stopped speaking and you started to reply, he was chanting. Yeah, so he would say something, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And you say something, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. And then he'd reply and then he'd keep on chanting. He couldn't stop. So if anybody knew about chanting, he did. He was a chanter. So apparently there was a conversation. Now, I didn't hear this personally. It was relayed to me by somebody else who heard it. I know there are slight variations on the story, as it always happens with anecdotes. Usually they get, you know, changed a little bit here and there. But the essence of this story is a fact, as I was told, that he was talking with another god brother, Bon Maharaj. Now, those of you that know our history a little bit know that Bon Maharaj was one of the devotees. He was the head of the party that was sent in the 1930s to London and England to begin some preaching work there. But after a couple of years, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was sending them 3,000 rupees a month from India to England just to support their activities. So that's how important. I mean, in 1930s, how much was a rupee worth? I mean, a lot. So after a couple of years, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati became a little disgusted that they couldn't do anything, and he called them back. Nothing tangible was set up. Maybe one person, I think some old lady was initiated, that was it. But nothing else. So Bon Maharaj, later on, he kept up some contacts with professors and academic kind of people in the West. And in the 70s, he was also going out and touring around a little bit, but only on that university kind of level. So after Prabhupada's disappearance, apparently Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji and Bon Maharaj were talking together. And Akinchana Krishnadas, he was praising Srila Prabhupada for, you know, all of his work in taking Krishna consciousness around the world, establishing ISKCON. And so he asked some questions to Bon Maharaj, 3 questions. So he asked him, he said, what is the difference between you and Swami Maharaj? Yeah, they used to call our Srila Prabhupada Swami Maharaj in the Gaudiya map. They still do. So he asked him this question. He said, what was the difference between you and Swami Maharaj? He said, you're a learned scholar. He was a learned scholar. You speak fluently in English. He was also fluently in English. You went to the West, and he went to the West. He was successful, and you were not. Why? So that was his question. And then he answered it himself. He said, because he had great faith in the holy names. So that was his appreciation why Prabhupada was successful. He just relied on the holy names, that's all. Now another god brother that came to see Prabhupada in March of 1976. We were in Mayapur. Prabhupada had gone there on January the 17th. He stayed there for just over 2 months. Gaur Purnima was, I think, on the 16th of March, like middle of March. And Prabhupada had extended an invitation to another very dear and close god brother, Srila B.R. Sridhar Swami. Now, Prabhupada had spent some time with him in the 1940s and 50s. They were living in the same building. Prabhupada had rented a place at number 6 Sita Kanta Banerjee Lane in Calcutta. There were some spare rooms next door, so he invited Sridhar Maharaj, I'll help you with the rent, you come here and just preach. So they were going out, and they used to go out and preach together here and there. So they knew each other extremely well. Their history went back, actually, to the time of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also. In 1935, Prabhupada had spent about 10 days in Radhakund when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was in residence there at their at his house. And he had helped the devotees to raise funds to begin a new center in Bombay. And Prabhupada had done business here. He used to live here sometimes. And he knew, you know, some wealthy people. So he went around and he was collecting money from his wealthy friends. And they established this Gaudiya Math center here in Bombay. And then there was the question of who was going to run it. And so in 1935, Sridhar Maharaj, who had been here in Bombay with Srila Prabhupada at that time, and I think the other devotee was Goswami Maharaj, they went to Radhakund. They were there with Srila Prabhupada. They were discussing about the new Bombay temple with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. And they said, we think that Abhay Babu, he should be the temple president. He's done so much. He's such a good organizer like this. So they wanted him to be the temple president. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, no. He said, he is better off outside of your company. He said, in the future, he will himself do everything. And Prabhupada told me, he said, when he said that, I was listening and I was thinking, how is that? He said, how is that possible? Then in the future, I will do everything? What does that mean? But he said, now I can understand that he knew. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, he already knew what was to come. Anyway, so Sridhar Maharaj was one of those devotees that was there in the room. And interestingly, Prabhupada told me that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had made a comment. Now, Srila Prabhupada was at that time what many members of the Gaudiya Math used to call a Kacha Grihastha. Yeah, you know what Kacha is. They used to call them rotten Grihasthas, the sannyasis and brahmacharis. So that was Prabhupada's. They were considered lower class in terms of preaching. So he was there, and Sridhar Maharaj was there. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta made a comment that he pointed to Sridhar Maharaj. He said, he knows the philosophy very well. Yeah, it was well known. He was a real, you know, had very high thoughts, wonderful philosopher. He really grasped everything. He said, he knows the philosophy very well, but his defect is he does not like to preach. So then he turned to Prabhupada. He said, you grab him, you drag him out and make him preach. So Prabhupada was given that instruction. And so that, you see, in the 50s then, that's what Prabhupada was trying to do. Anyway, long story, off the point. But Sridhar Maharaj then anyway had this very close connection and affection for Prabhupada that was reciprocated with Srila Prabhupada. And so when Prabhupada came to Mayapur in 1976, he invited Sridhar Maharaj to come to his temple, Mayapur Chandradaya Mandir, and just, you know, spend an afternoon with him so that he could bring him up to date on all the preaching that was going on all around the world. And the following year, in 77, then Sridhar Maharaj reciprocated and Prabhupada went to his mat, and I think sometime in February. So like that. So anyway, this was a very interesting meeting on March the 15th, 1976. And Sridhar Maharaj came over. Prabhupada sent his car to pick him up. They took lunch together. Then they rested in rooms next to each other. And then they had a couple of hours just talking in Prabhupada's room. So nobody else was in there, just the two of them. Then in the late afternoon, Sridhar Maharaj returned back to his temple in Navadvip. So during their conversations, they exchanged reports on each other's preaching activities. Srila Prabhupada told me afterwards, so as soon as Sridhar Maharaj left, I was in Prabhupada's room. I wanted to know what was going on. Naturally curious. And Prabhupada did share a little something. So he told me that Sridhar Maharaj had told him that he regarded him as the real Acharya. Sridhar Maharaj told him that Lord Chaitanya had given this prediction that the chanting of the holy names would go to every town and village. But he and his godbrothers had not taken this statement literally. they actually thought it was, all right, something nice and poetic, you know, every town and village in the whole world. What could that possibly mean? You know, everywhere, it's just Meletius and Yavanus. How could that be possible? Maybe it just means, you know, everywhere in India. That's the real world, that's Bharat. So that must be what the meaning is. But it's a nice poetic description that they were thinking. So he told Srila Prabhupada, that's the way that we were thinking. But he said, now, because of you, he said, I can understand the real meaning to this verse. He said, you have actually done it. He said, therefore, you are the real Acharya. There's a whole other thing I could go into there about Acharyas, but we'll leave that one for another day. But that was particularly significant coming from Sridhar Maharaj. So anyway, there's a couple of God brothers that did appreciate what Srila Prabhupada was doing in terms of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and the effect that it had. So let's look at an interesting little document that Prabhupada printed up just when he was preparing to go to the West for the first time. So he didn't, you know, Prabhupada was thinking about his preaching, what he would do when he arrived in the West. He had made an arrangement for 200 or 300 sets of his trilogy, the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It was published in 3 parts. So he had Samati Mararaji. They loaded up 200 or 300 sets of his books. They were sent down to Cochin from here, and they were loaded onto the ship down there. But the ship was setting sail from Calcutta, and that's where Prabhupada boarded it. The day before he got on board, he went to Mayapur, and he spent some time there at the Samadhi of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur chanting. And he just went there to get the blessings of his Guru Maharaj before he set off on this trip. So Prabhupada, of course, had never been out of India before. He was just about to turn 70. So very, you know, at the fag end of his life, as he said. And now he was going out on this whole new, you know, adventure with just his books, because he was not allowed by the Indian government. They didn't allow people to take money out of the country. I think 40 rupees or something. So he was going, you know, literally penniless. But he was thinking about what he would do when he arrived there. So he had a little introductory leaflet printed up, and he was going to give that out to people when he met them, and it would explain to them why he was coming to America. In other words, he wasn't going as a tourist. He had a purpose. And so he was going to pass this leaflet out to everybody to make sure that they understood what he was there for. So in 1976, on August the 4th, right, this is 11 years later, Prabhupada was visiting New Mayapur, which is in France. That's our 200-acre property there, big castle. And somebody brought one of those original leaflets into Prabhupada's room and put it on his desk. So apparently Prabhupada hadn't seen it for quite a few years. So as soon as he saw it on the desk, he immediately asked me, he said, just read it. Read it out. So Prabhupada was sitting back. I sat there with the leaflet. So it was very interesting. Prabhupada's picture was on the front, and it had a title reading, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's Message of Peace and Goodwill. 60 volumes of elaborate English translation by Tridandi Goswami, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Carried by the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company Limited, Bombay, all over the world, for scientific knowledge of God. So that was the header. And then Prabhupada said, read the rest. So as he relaxed behind his desk, I read out the body of the text. It says, the sufferings of the entire human society can at once be brought under control simply by individual practice of bhakti yoga, a simple and easy process of chanting the holy name of God. Every country, every nation, and every community throughout the world has some conception of the holy name of God. And as such, either the Hindus or the Mohammedans or the Christians Everyone can easily chant the holy name of God in a meditative mood, and that will bring about the required peace and goodwill in the present problematic human society. Any inquiry in this connection will be gladly answered by Sri Swamiji. The Hindus generally chant the holy name of God in 16 chain of transcendental sound, composed of 32 alphabets, as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The Vedic literatures like the Upanishads and Puranas recommend chanting of the above mentioned 16 holy names at a stretch, and also Lord Sri Chaitanya, whose cult of chanting the holy name of God gave special importance on these transcendental sounds. In this age of Kali, or the age of hate, hypocrisy, corruption, and quarrel, the only remedial measure is that every man should chant the holy name of the Lord both individually and collectively. Then it went on to give the English translations of the 8 prayers by Lord Chaitanya, Shikshastakam, in glorification of the holy name. And it ended with some highly complimentary reviews of Prabhupada's translation of the Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada was, you know, listening to what he had written there. And it's very interesting if you look at the composition of that text and that one little tract, everything that was Srila Prabhupada is right there. Yeah, if you look at the header, there are 3 things that stand out. First of all, he says 60 volumes of elaborate English translation. He only had 3 volumes, right? The first canto, he was 70 years old, but he was already advertising 60 volumes. That's Prabhupada's ambition. He didn't think small. Prabhupada always thought big. Yeah, and he was very positive. They always talk about the power of positive thinking. You can't get any more positive thinking than Srila Prabhupada. 60 volumes. How he was going to do it, that's another thing, but that's what he was advertising. Then the second thing is that he's carried by this India Steamship Company all over the world. He'd only been given a free passage to America. There was no mention about a ticket all around the world. You know, Prabhupada was just going to go and try and do something in New York. That was it. But already he's advertising all over the world. And then the third thing, for scientific knowledge of God. So that, again, is a challenge. Yeah? Scientific knowledge of God. Anybody who's a scientist, they'll ask you, where does God come into science? Yeah? And especially in the 1960s, in fact, in early 1966, I think in the March or April edition of Time magazine, which is the most famous magazine in the whole world, they had on the cover of the Time magazine, God is Dead. That was their cover article. So that's just when Prabhupada had started preaching in New York City. That was what he was confronting. God is dead. Science is God. And Prabhupada's here advertising, before he sets off, scientific knowledge of God. He knew very well what was going on, you know, amongst the academics and the scientists, the atheism, materialism that they were advertising and spreading all over the world. So it was a challenge. He deliberately used that word, this is science, the Srimad Bhagavatam. Real science is in the Bhagavatam, not all these mental speculations of, you know, so many big scholars and PhDs and Nobel laureates. They pass that off as science. But the real science, oh, that's just mythology, it's just sentiment. You have to separate, you know, real knowledge from religion. All right, it's nice, religion is just some sentiment, it gives you good feelings, makes people happy, you know. You can talk about peace and love and all these kinds of things. But when you really want to talk about knowledge, you have to talk about science. Prabhupada went there to challenge that. He was going to challenge every scientist in the world. And as he said, kick them on the face. That's all. Beat them with shoes. He was going to do that. That was his determination. So those three things you can see right there in just in the header. What to speak about the rest of the text. That was Prabhupada's declaration, his opening statement. I'm here to spread this movement all over the world. I'm going to give you the entire science of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, the other part that's interesting in that is that he's presenting a simple formula for solving all the problems of the world. It sounds completely fundamentalist, right? Sentimental. Oh, you just do this one thing, everything will be fixed up, right? This whole huge world with all the fighting. He was going into a country that was already at war in several places, you know, Vietnam War, right in the middle of it. They were fighting on their own campuses, on the universities, as well as in Vietnam. He was going right into the middle of that, and what to speak about all the other problems that were going on in other countries around the world. At any one time, everybody they'll tell you there's at least, you know, two dozen wars, big and small, going on in so many places. So, human society, very complex. The problems, very complex. The social structures, the political structures, the economic structures. You know, and here's this humble, simple sadhu coming from Vrindavan. He's never set foot out of India. And he's telling everybody, I will give you the means to solve all the problems in the world. What is it? Chant the names of God. It sounds so simplistic and, you know, fundamental, sentimental, whatever. Who will take that seriously? But Prabhupada was dead serious. It's not simple. Actually, Prabhupada had analyzed why there are all the problems there in the world. It's not because of all the external things that are going on. Yeah, all the conflicts between, you know, the nationalism and the communism and the capitalism and all what he said, the isms, and all the different complex structures that people have created in the external world. That's not where the solution to the problems lies. Make as many planning commissions as you like, you know. You make as many committees as you like. You make as many social structures and political structures as you like. The problems will continue. They'll multiply. And they have. They're always there. You look in the history of Europe and America. Oh, well, not America doesn't have a history, but Europe does. fighting, that's all. For thousands of years, all they've done is fight with each other, and it's still going on. The same business is going on. Prabhupada's coming there and saying, I'll give you the solution. Just chant Hare Krishna or any name of God. Why? Because you cannot solve any problem externally. The reason why there are problems externally is because there are problems internally. Because people's hearts are not clean. Their hearts are not peaceful. People are not satisfied, and therefore their frustrations, their, you know, lower propensities, anger, hatred, envy, lust, greed, that's all in the heart. It comes out into, you know, the external world, and therefore you have so much disturbance because people are disturbed internally. So Prabhupada knew that if you want to solve the problems of the world, you have to solve the problems of one person. Right? You have to solve your own problem. It's inside. And you can do that by chanting Hare Krishna. That cleanses the heart. When the heart becomes peaceful, now automatically your external dealings will also reflect what's within. And therefore he's saying, this is the remedial measure for this age of hate, hypocrisy, corruption and quarrel. You just chant this Hare Krishna mantra and see the effects. And then the last thing that he says is, both individually and collectively. Chant your japa, chant in kirtan, or sankirtan. That is Lord Chaitanya's movement. So that's what Prabhupada went to the West to bring to the people of the world. And he did it, of course, extremely effectively. So because he had absolute faith in the holy names, that was it. Then everything else was arranged by Krishna. There's one class that Prabhupada gave, I think it was in Los Angeles in 76. He said, don't think that I'm responsible for bringing this movement all around the world. He said this was Krishna's desire. Because he wanted it, that's why it has happened. This movement is directly the manifestation of Lord Krishna's will. Because Prabhupada was being very humble. Krishna's will is executed through his willing servants. And that was Srila Prabhupada. Because he was the most willing, therefore he got the biggest service. That's all. There were other servants. Their service is also valid. But what Prabhupada did shows the bigness or the largeness of his heart. Yeah, the openness of his own heart, the cleanliness, if you like, of his own heart, that he was able to manifest Krishna's will on such a huge scale. So anyway, Prabhupada went there then with a determination, not as a tourist. Yeah, he used to say, all these other swamis and yogis, they're going there, but the real business, tourism, that's all. Get some money and enjoy, you know, the facilities of the Western countries. But not Prabhupada, yeah. So, one conversation we had with Srila Prabhupada when that came up, again, it was in France, and we were chit-chatting about Prabhupada's efforts to spread Krishna consciousness around the world, how difficult it was to introduce, you know, the Vedic culture into a society of gross meat-eaters, drunkards, etc. So, Prabhupada was laughing. And then he told us a little story about just some festival that he had attended in Vrindavan just before he came to the West. And it involved this other god brother, Bon Maharaj. So he was laughing. He said, our Bon Maharaj. So he said, once I was eating at his festival. And he's a Bada Sahib. Everybody knows what a Bada Sahib is, right? A big Westerner. Yeah. I mean, that's a term that was applied. I don't know whether you use it nowadays, but it used to be in colonial times. It was applied to, you know, Indians that wanted to become like Westerners, became, you know, dressed up like Westerners and adopted Western manners, Western food, Western education. Everything had to be British. Then you were, you know, a big man. So the more traditionalists, they are, oh, he's a Bada Sahib. He's become a big Westerner. It's a way of mocking somebody, actually. So Prabhupada was talking about his godbrother, Bon Maharaj. He said, oh, he's a Bada Sahib. So he is given, in this festival, he is given a fork and a knife. So I did not know. I do not remember even which way I took the fork. So Bon Maharaj began to criticize. Oh, you are going to the foreign country and you do not know which hand to take this fork and knife? So I told him, I'm not going to learn all these things. I am going to teach them something else, to forget it. You you went there to teach, to learn all these things, but I'm not going there to learn anything. So that was Prabhupada. You know, he was going there to teach us something, not to learn something. And again, June 21st, 1976, Prabhupada had just flown into Pittsburgh Airport from Toronto, and he was going to go to New Vrindavan. So he was picked up at the airport there by the devotees, and it was about a 90-minute ride on the highway. So as we were driving along, Prabhupada was keeping up a running conversation. So he reflected on the fallen condition of modern man, telling Kirtananda Maharaj his comparison of the dogs running on four legs and man's running on four wheels. So this was something that Prabhupada had thought about when we were in Hawaii in May. We were there for a month, and every day he would be driven down to the seafront. So our temple is up in the hills, and we had to go down on the main highway and then zip down to Magic Island. That's a promontory there. So as Prabhupada would, you know, he would sit in the back of the car and he would look out the window and he'd see all the motor cars zipping up and down the highway, yeah, fast, 70 miles an hour. And especially when we came back, of course, everybody was by that time going to work. So there'd be all these cars zipping up and down the highway. And Prabhupada was sitting there, and one day he looked out, he said, "What is the difference?" He said, "The dog is running on four legs, and they're running on four wheels, but the business is the same." He said, "No difference. That's just wheels instead of legs. That's all." So he was telling Kirtananda the same thing, that comparison. And he said, the only way to save them is to start with the basics, and then after some time, when they become a little purified, then you give them some philosophy. He reminded Kirtananda that this had been his program right from the very beginning. "You have all got this experience," he said. "This is the only way. I started this movement on this determination. I'll give them prasadam, nice chanting, and they will not come. They must come. That was my determination. And I began with this. So this is the only way. Give them a chance. No talk. Please come. Chant and dance with us and take Krishna prasadam and go home." No talk. Just chant, dance, eat, go home. Kirtananda reflected that it was just 10 years since he had first met Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada gave one of his endearing little sideways nods of assent. India. Yeah. When we first came to India, we couldn't figure that one out. Yeah, because in the West, that means no. This means yes. So when, oh yes. The bodily language was completely confusing. Anyway, Prabhupada was yes. "I never said that you have to give this up. You have to do this. I never said. Then gradually, chaito darpanam arjanam. When the heart becomes a little cleansed, then you give a little philosophy. So, there is no hopelessness." So, Prabhupada had it all planned out. He knew what he was doing from day one, even before that. So, anyway, referring back then to the old days in New York, I was just there actually this summer for the New York Rath Yatra. And I gave a program in 26 Second Avenue. So we were talking on this. And there's one comment that Prabhupada made in a class, December the 8th, 1975. This was in Vrindavan. I'd just joined Prabhupada's party a week before. And he was giving his class. And he recalled how in the early days of ISKCON in New York, his neighbors would protest at the morning chanting. So he told us, in the beginning, in that 2nd Avenue, 26, when our morning prayer was going on at 7, not very early. So many of the other tenants, that the building was tenanted by other people, half naked, they would complain to the landlord, "Mr. Judah, what is going on? What is going on? Stop it! Stop it! Stop!" So Mr. Judah used to say, "No," he was the landlord. "No, no, they'll not stop. I cannot say. You have to go to the police." That's Prabhupada chanting in the bottom there. So sometimes Prabhupada said the police were coming to stop us, but we didn't stop. So, because I was told that's still going on there. Yeah, even now. When I was giving this seminar, they stopped me at 9 o'clock in the evening. And they said, "Now we have to stop. The neighbors made so many complaints that they actually passed the law that we can't do any more kirtan after 9 o'clock at night." So it was going on when Prabhupada was there in 66, and it's still going on even now. But anyway, Prabhupada was laughing. But that was his determination. You know, he was seemingly this innocuous, simple little sadhu. You know, when he stayed with Sally Agarwal in Butler, his first few weeks there in America, she was convinced, you know, he's completely harmless. He's just come here for a visit. He's a nice old man. You know, what is he going to do? She couldn't think that he would do anything. Yeah, but Prabhupada, you know, his determination was he was going to destroy the entire Western civilization. That's what he really came for. And so you see there immediately that, you know, same thing. The first time that he went out chanting in public, after a couple of months in the storefront there, problems with the neighbors, not stopping. He went downtown, Tompkins Square Park. He sits down in the middle of the lawn there. The devotees sit around him. He starts chanting in public. They're all embarrassed, but because Prabhupada's doing it, they sit and they tag along, and they do it. They got their courage from Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada's completely oblivious, seemingly, to whatever else is going on. He's there to chant, and he wants people to hear him. Yeah. Up until then, they'd just been in the storefront, and so only the people that were coming to him, they were chanting, and it was kind of private. And the early devotees, they liked that, you know, because it was so strange and different. They liked it that they were doing it in private. But Prabhupada had other plans. He walked out the door, he went down the street, and they had to follow him. And then he sat down and started chanting in public. That was the first public kirtan. And, you know, he's chanting away, and then they get into it. They lose themselves in the chanting. There's a big crowd that gathers around them, and everybody's looking, what's going on, you know, strange people, you know. And then, at a certain point, one of the park wardens, you know, the officials, he came over and he stopped it. And he said, can't you read? And there's a big sign there. They're all sat in the middle of the lawn there. And there's a big sign at the side that says, keep off the grass. And Prabhupada's sitting there right on the grass. So then Prabhupada said, oh, okay. So he gets up, he walks off the grass and sits right down on the pavement and starts chanting again. So the warden, he was kind of flummoxed. He got them off the grass, but they were sitting on the footpath. So what to do? So he just walked off. Prabhupada carried on chanting. So that was Srila Prabhupada. Nothing was going to stop him from this mission. Nothing was going to stop him from chanting Hare Krishna. Now that determination, of course, got infused into his disciples. Then, of course, the next place was the airports. So when Prabhupada took his first aeroplane flight, it was from New York to San Francisco in January of 1967, not long after he'd started the storefront, 6 months. But by that time, Mukunda, he had gone back to California, and he'd become initiated, and he had started telling all his hippie friends about this far-out Swami, you know, and this chanting, and he taught them the mantra. And then he saw the interest was there, so he'd written to Prabhupada and said, why not come to San Francisco? We can find another place like we have in New York, and there's so many people that are waiting for you here. So Prabhupada immediately, yes, let's go. Of course, all the New Yorkers, oh no, how can you go to California? Because in America, there's a big competition between L.A. and New York. There's a rivalry. So the New Yorkers, they were thinking, oh no, Swamiji is going to go. What can we do? What will we do without him? You know, they were just getting into this new lifestyle, and they just started to really surrender to Prabhupada, and now he was going to go off. Brahmananda told me, he said, you know, those early months in 26 Second Avenue, he said, you know, that was the whole world, that little storefront. Yeah, nothing else existed. There was Prabhupada and the storefront and nothing else. And then he said, you know, the idea that our conception was that Krishna consciousness would just be there in that one place, in that little storefront, and that would be it. And we'd live happily ever after with Swamiji. You know, chanting Hare Krishna. But within 6 months, Prabhupada was off. You know, he wanted to go somewhere else and begin, you know, a new center there. So when he flew into San Francisco, he gets off the aeroplane, and right there in the airport, there's all these young boys and girls, hippies mainly, and they're all chanting Hare Krishna already because Mukunda's got them there and they had a reception. So they all just started chanting. As soon as they saw Prabhupada, it just happened spontaneously. So what did Srila Prabhupada do? No, not in the airport. No, let's not disturb anything. Let's wait till we get back to the... No, Prabhupada puts his hands up in the air and he starts chanting and dancing right there in the middle of the airport. All the people going around. That was Srila Prabhupada. He had no embarrassment whatsoever about being a devotee. You know, it was the most natural thing in the universe. And so wherever he was, as he said, it's Krishna's back garden. Yeah, it's not like, oh, people sometimes, the reporters would ask him, what do you think about our country? Is this strange? And Prabhupada said, no, why? It's Krishna's backyard. That's all. Everywhere is Krishna's. I feel at home everywhere. And he did. So he was chanting. So anyway, the devotees learnt that. Just go out and chant. And then later on, when, you know, more opposition started coming in, then Prabhupada started showing his real determination. So in the early 70s, when the devotees first went to London, because that was the first major center to be opened outside of America. And very quickly, you know, after they started chanting on the street, then they started running into trouble with the London bobbies, you know, the policemen there with their little hats. And they started getting arrested. And then, you know, there was a lot of fighting and arresting and, you know, they'd be taken into court and fined and so many things. And that became a typical pattern in many cities around the world as the movement began to spread. 1968, there was probably about 5 or 6 temples and about 60 initiated devotees. By the end of 1972, there were 60 temples in many on every continent, and there were over 600 devotees initiated. By the end of 1977, there were 5,000 initiated devotees and 108 temples all around the world. So you can see that from 68 onwards, there was this tremendous expansion of ISKCON all around the world. Devotees went to Africa, they went to America, to Europe, they went to South America, they went to, of course, back to India, they went to Japan, they went all through Southeast Asia, they went to Australia and New Zealand. It just spread like anything. So as we were spreading, you know, because we had no direct contact with Prabhupada, I joined in 72 in Sydney at the beginning of the year, and it was a bit like America was in 68. It was at that stage of development. There were a few devotees, but the temple president of Sydney Temple, when I joined, was 19 years old. Yeah, 19 years old. He'd been in the movement, I think, 2 years or 3 years, something like that. And he was the temple president. And when I joined the temple, there were, I think, 10 or 12 devotees. That was in mid-February. When Prabhupada came on April the 1st, there were 44 devotees living in the temple. So in 6 weeks, we went from 10 to 44. So it was like a boom time. And so when we started, when I joined, the only activity that we did was going out chanting Hare Krishna on the street. That was my first contact with the devotees. I had emigrated from England in May of 71. And, we left in April. It was a one-month boat ride. We landed in Sydney, I think around about May the 16th or 17th. It was 1 or 2 days after Prabhupada had just left after his first visit there. Anyway, the devotees were out on the street. I was walking around with my friends the first day off the boat. We hear this singing, you know, and then we see these strange people with the robes and the shaved heads and the saris and, you know, what's this? Because, you know, I was immediately attracted to that and I bought a BTG. But that's what the devotees did. That was their only activities. They stood on that street corner for 4 or 5 hours every day. Same street corner. And they would just chant and chant and chant. And then they go back to the temple, have a little break, then come back again and chant for another couple of hours. And that was pretty typically, you know, ISKCON in the early 70s. Book distribution had not really come into force at that point. So everybody was out. You know, we had this fervor of preaching. Prabhupada had instilled that in us. Go out, give the holy names to as many people as possible. So we did that. And we spent many hours every day doing that. So I joined, there was 10 devotees. So usually maybe about 4 or 5 devotees would go out and stand on the street corner and chant. But by the time Srila Prabhupada came, we had 45 devotees. And the Sankirtan party had increased up to 20, 25, sometimes 30 devotees. So we would go out, we would stand on the street corner in the middle of the city, 25 of us, and we'd chant Hare Krishna for 4 hours. And so all the people that worked in the buildings, the shop owners, the shop assistants, the people that were working in the offices, they were all going crazy. Right? Because this chanting's going on, you know, hour after hour after hour, every single day. And they, you know, they couldn't do their work. So they started making complaints to the city officials. So not long after Prabhupada's visit, then we started running into trouble. And some order was given to the police that they should stop these people from coming out on the street and causing a disturbance. So every time we would go out, we would line up. Sometimes we would go in front of one of the big department stores, Woolworths. Or there was a place that, what, the biggest department store in Sydney is called Myers. Yes. It's the most, you know, upscale department store, Myers. So we'd line up in front, all the shop windows, and we'd chant. Then what happened was that the police, you know, they would try to stop us. So we would chant, and after 4 or 5 minutes maybe, then all of a sudden we see the police wagon, yeah, come racing around the corner. And we wait, and we watch them to see if they were going to go past or whether they would stop. So inevitably, they would suddenly brake really hard. They'd stop right in front of us, and 3 or 4 cops would jump out the van, and they'd run at the devotees. And then as soon as we saw them stop, all the devotees, we'd just run everywhere. We'd run across the road. We'd run into the stores. I remember running into Myers. And there was a couple of us, and there was a policeman after us. And we ran up the escalators onto the next floor. There was the women's clothing department there. And they had, you know, all these racks of dresses hanging in rows. So we ran into the rows and hid inside the hid inside the clothes racks there. The policeman was looking. He couldn't see us, so he went off. So it was a lot of fun, actually. usually they'd catch one or two. There was a devotee called Dwipayana who used to play the guitar all the time. So generally they would catch him because he couldn't run with the guitar. whoever was playing the mridanga, they would get caught as well. So they'd take him downtown. They would, you know, issue some citation, some fine. They'd write out ticket, and then we're supposed to go and appear in the court later on, and, you know, the magistrate would fine you for obstruction or whatever it was that they'd booked you for. Anyway, so for some time, you know, we were doing that, but then it became really heavy. It got so difficult that we had a couple of girls, they just went out shopping one day. They were just walking down the road, and the police went past. Oh, there's the Hare Krishnas. They jumped out and grabbed them and took them to the police station. They weren't doing anything. Yeah. So we adopted a different tactic. Instead of standing on one street corner, you know, a huge group, we thought, well, let's break up into small groups. So we had pairs, 2 devotees standing on every street corner. So instead of all the devotees on one street corner, we had, you know, 2 devotees on every street corner. So wherever you went around the city area, there were devotees there. One with the cartels chanting Hare Krishna, and the other one selling back to Godheads. And we would swap over every half hour. Anyway, that also, we were getting harassed. The police didn't like that. They'd run around and capture us. So it became really difficult. Then we thought, now, another tactic. Let's get off the street and go door to door. So we tried that for a short period, but the problem with that was that during the daytime, everybody's at work. So you go and knock on all the doors, nobody's in. Yeah, or maybe just 1 or 2 old people that don't, not working anymore. So it was difficult. So then it became a big dilemma what to do. We were still trying to do our chanting, but even then on the Saturday night kirtan, when we go down, you know, the popular entertainment areas, the movie theaters, or in Sydney they have King's Cross. That's kind of like the red light district. So we'd go chanting there, and still the police would come and harass us. So it got so bad. Then also the city council, they have their own officers, not police. They have their own officers. So they adopted a tactic with us. Now, what happened was in May of 72, Madhavisa Swami came from India, and he became our new GBC. So he saw what was going on, and he decided on a different tactic. He said, all right, we'll have a small party, and we'll do Naga Sankirtan. We'll just keep moving. So we won't stand anywhere. We'll just have six or seven devotees, and we'll just keep on chanting and moving all around the city like that. But by that time, the city authorities had become so angry with us that they just wanted to get rid of us. So they were preparing a case against us that they could take to court, and the application would be that these Hare Krishnas are a nuisance. They should be banned completely from the streets. So they started sending out a couple of officers every day. And, you know, we'd be out there chanting and moving around. And then they would come up and they would stop us. One of them had a camera and the other one had his notebook. So they would stop us, and then individually they would say, all right, son, what's your name? And then you had to tell your name, and the other guy would take a photograph of you so that they could match up the names with the photographs. So we would say, he'd say, what's your name? Oh, Prasadam Das. Or Samosa Das. Or Samsara. Right, Sam is the name in the West. Samsara. Like that. And they'd write it down and take the photograph, and then they'd let us go on. So they were building up this case. So then around about August, September time, then we heard this case is going to come to court. Big thing. What to do? So Charu Prabhu, he was, by that time, I think he was our temple president. Same Charu that's in Spanish Fork there. So he got worried, and he was thinking, you know, do we get a lawyer? Should we stop doing Sankirtan? Because we had no other income. Whatever we got from selling BTGs on the street, that was it. That was what we were living on. And it wasn't much, I can tell you. We used to go out, I'd sell 4 or 5 BTGs. If I had a really good day, I might sell 8 or 10. The best distributors would sell maybe 12, 15 Back to Godhead magazines. You'd get maybe 20 cents a magazine. So total collection for each person, maybe $2. And we had to support the whole temple on that. So if we couldn't go out on the street, we had literally no income. What were we going to do? So Charu wrote to Srila Prabhupada to ask him what's the best thing to do. And he had investigated, you know, hiring a lawyer. But then he found out, you know, the lawyers, they charge like $100 an hour or $200 an hour. So it was, they worked it out. It might cost like $1,000, you know, just to get a representation in the court there. And, you know, that was, it was just way beyond our means. In fact, at that time, we were probably 2 or 3 months behind with the rent on the building that we were in. So to think about spending $1,000 on a lawyer, it was just, you know, out of our imagination. So he wrote to Prabhupada, should we take a loan from the BBT? And then we can pay it back over so many years. Yeah. So anyway, he wrote to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada received that letter. That was sent on August the 31st, 1972. Prabhupada was in Dallas when he received it. And he sent his reply on the 10th of September. So he says, my dear Charu, please accept my blessings. I'm in due receipt of your letter dated August the 31st, 1972, and I've noted the contents carefully. Now, regarding this business of Sankirtan, the solution is to simply go on with Sankirtan activities as you have been doing, and let them arrest us if they like. We will not stop. Just like in London, they became arrested so many times, and there was so much public display of arresting that gradually the police stopped arresting them, and now they can have Sankirtan anywhere they like without any botheration. If we take this case into court and spend so much money for big, big lawyers, and still if we do not win, then they will have a legal right to stop us. So better to forget this business of lawyers and judges and simply go on with your Sankirtan. That is civil disobedience movement. Let them fill their jails with us again and again, but we shall not stop our Sankirtan movement. Also, it may help to get some public sympathy through publicizing our constant persecution in the newspaper journals. Gradually, the city officials and constabulary will become embarrassed to arrest us further, and gradually we will be allowed to carry on with our Sankirtan unhampered. But I do not think this business of expensive lawyers and going to court will solve anything. Better to simply become determined to hold our Sankirtan in our own manner as we like, and simply depend upon Krishna and his protection at all times. Hoping this meets you in good health, your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So that was typed up and signed by Prabhupada, and then he added another couple of sentences as a postscript on the bottom. So in the postscript he says, P.S., there is no difference between our chanting on the street, or in a temple, or in jail. A Krishna conscious person is not afraid of any place, but he wants to chant constantly in all circumstances. So that was it. Prabhupada said, if Prabhupada said it, that was the absolute truth. No question of doing anything else. We didn't bother with the court case. We just, when actually it came to court, they had their big lawyers there and they had all their information and the photographs and the names and everything. Now, one thing was that they couldn't sue ISKCON because we didn't officially exist. We weren't incorporated. We had no legal status. In those days, we had bank accounts, but in those days you could just walk in any bank and open up an account, even in the name of a society, without showing any documents. So, you know, we were operational, but we were not legal. We didn't have any legal status, so there was nobody for them to identify as ISKCON. They couldn't sue us. So the only thing that they could do was bring the case against the individuals that they'd photographed on the street. So naturally, when the case came up to court, we sent those devotees off to Melbourne and Brisbane and other places. And we didn't go to court anyway. We didn't have a lawyer. We didn't even go ourselves because we were out in Sankirtan. You know, Prabhupada said, just keep on chanting. So that's what we did. So they had the case and they lost. They made their presentation and then the judge, nobody was there. Every time they called up, you know, Prasadam Das. Where is this guy? And the judge was asking them, is he even in Sydney? Do you know if he lives in Sydney still? If he doesn't live in Sydney, then how can you bring the case against him? So it is. So at the end of it, he just, on technical reasons, he said, nobody's here. You haven't proved your case. He said, you know, dismissed. And then he made an interesting comment at the end. It was reported in the newspapers. That's how we heard it. He made an interesting comment. He said, I think they add a lot of color to the city. Let them go on. So apparently he had seen us chanting and he liked it. So he just casually dismissed the whole case. So it became a big scandal. It was on all the newspapers afterwards. Anyway, that was 72. So in 1976, I was with Srila Prabhupada in Mayapur. This was on February the 4th. He just got a letter from Caracas in South America. Some of the devotees were down there and they were having the same problems. They were chanting, the police was arresting them. They were writing to Prabhupada to ask what to do. So, of course, Prabhupada gave them the same advice. So I was there as Prabhupada's servant by that time, and so it reminded me. And Prabhupada asked me, he said, you had the same problem, yeah, in Sydney. So I said, yes. In Sydney, they spent $10,000, the city council, to compile a case against us. It was reported in the newspapers. Every day they used to come and film us and take our names. We didn't contest the case, but we just carried on with our sankirtan, and the judge threw them out of court. They spent $10,000. It was a big scandal, and they lost the case. And the judge said, why not let them go on the streets? They add a lot of color to the city. So Prabhupada liked that. He was smiling. And I had told him some other things about that particular case. So later in the year, in late October of 76, we got news about another court case that was being brought against the devotees in New York. Now, this was not exactly to stop us from doing sankirtan on the street, because that was well established by that time. But we had another problem, and that problem was with a group called the deprogrammers. So this was a group of gundas that were hired by a party of parents of devotees that didn't like their children becoming devotees. They thought maybe they'd gone crazy, yeah, because they'd given up their lifestyles and become, you know, like madmen. So they had started kidnapping devotees right off the street sometimes. They would take them away and then they would lock them up and then they would subject them to all kinds of treatment to try to, you know, deconvert them or deprogram them. Their feeling was that for people to act so strangely, they must be brainwashed. Yeah, they're like robots. They don't know what they're doing anymore. They're being controlled. Their minds are being controlled, you know, like this. So this was a big thing. So we were more or less at war with these deprogrammers. And a couple of our devotees had been captured in New York, Murti Vanyadasi and Basu Gopal Das. They had been taken away and attempted to be deprogrammed. And they would do horrible things. You know, sometimes it was in the parents' house. Sometimes they would hire a motel. They would go to the court and get a 30-day, just forget the legal name for it, Punapragya. Do you know what it is? They get a remand order that enables the parents to get temporary control over their children, even if they're adults. But they get some psychiatrist to say, yes, he's become crazy. He's not fit to do his own affairs. So then a conservation order, something like that. And they get an order from the court. The parents come in and they can legally take you away, yeah, and take care of you. So they were doing that, and they would lock them up, and then they would force them to eat meat. They would take pictures of Krishna and Prabhupada and tear them up and spit on them and stamp on them on the floor. If the devotees started chanting, you know, to keep their Krishna consciousness, sometimes they would stuff ice cubes into their mouths to stop them from chanting. They would make them drink liquor and alcohol, different kinds of alcohol, anything to deprogram them and make them normal. So anyway, these two devotees, they escaped. And they came back to the temple. So we thought, you know, the New York temple authorities, they thought, this is too much. We've got to do something legal here. So they approached the state prosecutor. His name was Michael Schwed. And they complained, you know, these people are kidnapping our devotees. They're doing so many horrible things. You should bring a case against them. We want them prosecuted. So if you want to bring a case against somebody in America, according to the American Constitution, I think the Fifth Amendment, something like that, one of the lawyers would know. In order to do that, you have to call a grand jury. You have to present information. And if the grand jury indicts the person, they issue some legal, you know, indictment, then the person can be brought to court and prosecuted. So this Michael Schwed, he called a grand jury, and the idea was that they were going to investigate our complaints against these parents and against these deprogrammers. But what they did was that they called the parents in and the deprogrammers. They heard from them. They didn't call our devotees. And then they brought a case against us. They reversed it. The grand jury was supposed to be looking at making a case against the deprogrammers, and instead they became convinced that we were the, you know, the demons, and they brought a case against us. So Adi Keshava, he was the temple president, Tridas was the Sankirtan leader, they were arrested, and they were charged with kidnapping, false imprisonment, mind control, brainwashing. It was unprecedented. Nobody had ever brought a case in the American history of brainwashing. There was no such legal term for it. It was a whole new thing. But they were insisting, no, they're so weird, they've become so crazy from all this repetitive chanting, they've gone bonkers. They're all crazy. Their minds are being controlled. We have to save them. So they brought the case against us. It became a big thing. So Prabhupada heard about that whilst we were in Chandigarh. We were just completing a pandal there in late October. And he was informed about that. Some newspaper reporter, there was a press conference. And he said, what about this thing in New York? And Prabhupada said, what's that? He said, your people have been charged with extortion and kidnap. Prabhupada says, all bogus. He didn't know the details at that time, but he immediately said, it's all bogus. Like that. Anyway, so then gradually we heard more about it. We got letters from the devotees explaining all the details. This, by the way, this whole episode comes up in volume 6 of my diary. I'm just working on this section right now. So November the 2nd, Prabhupada's back in Vrindavan. And we were having a talk in his room. And we were talking about this court case. So Prabhupada, you know, we were discussing how, you know, Western civilization, they see us as a threat. So he was saying, yes, he said, that's their feeling, that this Krishna consciousness movement is spreading so fast, like an epidemic, and we must take some steps to stop them. He's saying about the, you know, the Karmis. So he got that from a letter Balavanta had sent him a few weeks before. Balavanta was the GBC in Southeast America, and I think Houston was one of his temples. So some state legislator, big man, he'd gone on the TV, and he was all alarmed about the Hare Krishnas, and he had made a statement on this, you know, popular TV show or on the news, something like that, that this Hare Krishna movement is spreading so fast, it's like an epidemic. He said, if we don't stop them, they'll take over the government within 10 years. So that was reported to Srila Prabhupada. He was so happy. He loved it. Yes, an epidemic. He said, yes, we will. That was his, he wanted that. He wanted to take over the whole government. So now we're sitting there in November. We're talking about this New York court case. And Prabhupada repeated that. He said, yes, to them, you know, it's like an epidemic, or we must take some steps to stop them. So, challenge. And then he turned to me and he said, and you said in Australia, there was one man that said that if people take to this movement, then where will we all stand? What was that you said? So I told him, I said, yes, there was one psychiatrist. So the Sydney City Council, they were trying to have us banned from the city altogether. And they took us to the court. And we didn't contest the case, but they still lost. And then afterwards, they worked out they'd spent $10,000 and so much manpower to try to get rid of us, and still it didn't work. So one newspaper man, he went to a psychiatrist, and he asked him, can you explain why there's this huge reaction against just a few people singing and dancing in the street? So he said, basically, it's because the city dwellers feel very threatened by our simple lifestyle. That was his analysis. It was in the newspaper. So Prabhupada smiled. He said, yes, just see. So this whole Western civilization is threatened. He liked that. He liked the idea that he was going to bring down the whole Western civilization. Okay, so that's a few things about Prabhupada's arrival in the West. the purpose, you know, that he came, the method that he employed for introducing the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, the determination that he had. He was fixed on it. He was going to do it come what may, put us in jail, do whatever you like, but we're going to keep on chanting. That was, and that's where we got it from. So I think now it's 2:45. I don't know. What's your schedule here? No schedule. What we'll do, somebody just unplugged me there. Oh, that's it. So I promised that we were going to have a slideshow. We'll do that now. Tomorrow evening, I guess. I'm going down to the hospital in the morning, but I'll be back in the evening. So if anybody would like to continue with this seminar, please come tomorrow evening for the evening program. And we'll take a look at, Prabhupada mentioned in that leaflet that he took with him, individual and collective chanting. So we have two sections. One is about individual chanting, japa. So the next section then on this seminar, we'll look tomorrow night at the chanting of japa. And then if this time later in the week, we might get to the kirtan part of it. So you're all invited. Now, this seminar, once I plug in, just give me a second. So this is a seminar. This PowerPoint slideshow, when I bring it up, I just got to find. Is that it? Here we go. So this is about the Bhaktivedanta archives. Okay. So I think most of you will have heard that we have an archive for Srila Prabhupada. Naturally, all the important documents, works, letters, films, everything to do with Srila Prabhupada. Immediately after his disappearance in 1977, we realized that we must have an archive. So this building that you can see here, this is it's a converted house. It's in North Carolina. And this is where we have our Bhaktivedanta archives. So we're going to have a look and see what an archive is, what are the activities, and what is its importance. So an archive, it means that it's a place where you keep one-of-a-kind materials, originals in other words, the original records of a time past. In an archive, you can do bottom-line research. It's not stagnant. Yeah, you store things, but it's not just a big storehouse. That's not an archive. An archive is active. It's a place where people can go and do research and go back to the original documents and find out what Prabhupada or whoever the archive is about, what they actually said, you know, under certain circumstances. The real story as it happens from the source. It's a place where records of yesterday are preserved for future generations, linking the past, the present, and the future. And that linkage, there's a proper system for that. It's called provenance. It's an actual concept. It's a science. How to keep the artifacts from the past linked up far, far into the future so that people in 200 years or 500 years or 1,000 years or 2,000 years can still trace back teachings or artifacts back to the original and be guaranteed this is bona fide. That's provenance. Very important concept. So we'll look and see Project Vani. Vani, of course, is the teachings. And this is a brief history. 1977, before Srila Prabhupada left us, one devotee, Paramarupa Prabhu, he saw all the audio recordings. In those days, we used to use these reel-to-reel tape recorders. It wasn't till mid-76 that we started using cassette recorders. So there were all these reels of recordings sitting in some storefront and nobody was doing anything with them, and he got concerned. He knew that that was Prabhupada's recordings. So he gathered them up. He persuaded the LA temple to give him one apartment opposite the temple so that he could store those recordings and then start, you know, cataloging them, going through them. We had at that time the Bhaktivedanta tape ministry, Prabhupada's tape ministry. So he wanted to start getting more materials for that. So that was just before Prabhupada left. Right after he did that, of course, Prabhupada left us in November of 77. So then, immediately in 78, we set up this archive. And those recordings were added to. We started to collect not just the audio, but documents. We put an appeal out to all the devotees, if you have any letters from Prabhupada. Because there was already a store of Prabhupada's original letters in Los Angeles. But now it became officially part of an archive. And Operation Vani began. So from 78 onwards, they started transcribing all the audio material. Huge job. And by 84, Operation Vani had concluded. It resulted in 40,000 pages of transcripts. Yeah, all the lectures and talks and conversations, 40,000 pages. Transcripts, letters, handwritten manuscripts, and all of that was microfilmed for storage. So that was in 6 years. A little of the history of the archives. In the 80s, we had some legal problems. People suing ISKCON temples. We got a little concerned that the archives maybe was at risk. You know, if somehow or another we lost a court case and some buildings or, you know, possessions of ISKCON could be taken. So we didn't want that to happen to the archives. So the archives was incorporated as its own entity, Bhaktivedanta Archives. And the BBT by that time had accumulated a huge amount of slides and photographs. They gave them to the archives. And at that point, they started audio transfer to DAT, D-A-T, digital format. So digital was just coming in at that time. Sorry, I just jumped something. And then in 1993, they moved from Los Angeles to North Carolina, because L.A. is right on the earthquake zone. It's not really the best place to put your archive. So they moved to a more stable area, North Carolina. So that's a brief history there. And then now we'll look at what came out from the archives. They weren't just accumulating material, but it needed to be made available. So publications is one aspect of that. 1988, once all the conversations had been transcribed, or practically all of them, then there was a demand. Devotees wanted to know, where is all this material? So they started publishing. So in 88, they began the Conversations with Srila Prabhupada series. That was printed on acid-free paper. Another part of archiving, you know, longevity. 38 volumes were eventually brought out, just the conversations. 91, all the lectures on the Bhagavad Gita were compiled together. 7 volumes. 92, all the lectures on Srimad Bhagavatam, another 7 volumes. No, sorry. 10 volumes. And also Prabhupada's letters. We didn't have those available at that time. Ajamil Prabhu sat down. He went through them and he made up 3 volumes, Shikshamrita. All Prabhupada's letters by topic from A to Z. Then, 94, Back to Godhead. So this book was 1944 to 1960. They went and they found all the old Back to Godheads that had been published prior to the formation of ISKCON, and they put them into a book form, Pioneer Years. In late 89, a devotee called Bali Mardan Prabhu came forward and gave the archives Prabhupada's original personal diary that he was keeping before he left on the Jaladuta and for a year afterwards. We didn't even know it existed. And then he came forward. He'd been keeping it safe. So he gave it to the archives. That was published in 95. Plus all the other lectures that weren't Bhagavatam or Gita, they were published as collected teachings, another 7 volumes. So that became a whole library of books, yeah, the Bhaktivedanta Library series. 97, the second half of Prabhupada's diary, The Beginning in New York, that was published. 98, all Prabhupada's favorite slokas, the most quoted ones, useful for preachers. So that was all the publications printed. Then also all the audio material, carrying on where the Bhaktivedanta Tape Ministry left off. In 77, I think there was probably about 300 cassettes that were available. By 92, they'd started the new tape ministry. They'd remastered a lot of the material, made it digital. So that expanded up to about 700 tapes or 750. Eventually, it went up to about 1,100, something like that. Then, they also, you know, Prabhupada made a lot of recordings singing bhajans. So the first musical collection, the archives were the first ones to come out with CDs. They were the latest thing. And they started the CD music collection. Then they started producing all the audio stuff instead of tapes. They moved over to CDs. So, 95, they ended up with 102 CDs, all Prabhupada's lectures, conversations, etc. They also brought out another vintage series, music series, the Morning Program, 2000. And in 2002, CDs also became a little old, and then they moved into MP3 format. So that MP3 audio library came out, 2002, Hare Krishna Melodies was another one. And then 2005, they did the MP3 second series. Now the difference was that the original MP3 series was just the recordings that were on cassette tape and just transferred over into MP3 format. The problem with that was many reel-to-reel recordings were 35 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes. But the cassette tapes that they were using were 30 minutes. So when the cassette tapes were coming out, they had to actually edit the original recordings to fit on the 30-minute format. When we moved to MP3, they saw there's no more rationale for doing that. So they went back and they remastered every single tape and brought them out in their original, you know, format, whatever, however long it was. So the 2005 series then was upgraded, remastered, 200 more additional tapes because digital technology had enabled us to clean up a lot of the tapes that were not listenable before, and then make them so that you could actually hear what was going on. And then we're restored to the original. So that's, you know, again, a huge amount of work. Then the third area, there's books, there's audio, computers were just coming in the mid-80s, personal computers. By 1991, the first computerized program, Bhagavad Gita as it is, on DOS. Those of you that are quite old, you might remember the DOS platform. So that was just the Bhagavad Gita. About 1993, the devotees went to Comdex in Los Angeles, Las Vegas. They found a company called Folio. They had a fantastic search engine. So they bought that Folio program. And then they started to put all the material onto that program. All the 40,000 transcripts, 40,000 pages of transcripts, and all of Prabhupada's books were scanned in. Interesting story how that happened. There was a guy called Adi Purana from New Zealand, really eccentric person, fanatic. And he turned up in Los Angeles, and he offered, now there was a a life member. He had some kind of like a photocopy store. He had a scanner. And scanners, you know, were not, they were not easily available in those days. They were very expensive machines. He had a scanner. And he was in Berkeley or San Francisco. So he offered, if you send somebody up, we can scan in every page of all of Prabhupada's books on my machine. And it will digitize it, and then you can put it on your program. Huge job. So Adi Purana went up to Berkeley. He was living in somebody's garage. And they told me that his main diet was ice cream and peanut butter. so every day, he was going into this man's shop. He was working in the shop. And whenever he had time, he would scan Prabhupada's books in. So that's how they all got, you know, scanned in, ready for the folio program. Plus the 40,000 transcripts. I mean, that's a lot of work. So by 95 then, we had the first Bhaktivedanta database. It came out. It was upgraded in 1999. A lot of new materials were added. More letters were being found. More transcripts were being made from the tapes, etc. And then 2003, then that was the last upgrade. So we have that. That's on DVD format. That saw additional materials being added. It combined the audio transcriptions, letters, documents, all the books published by the BBT, all many books by other authors. So just like my books, four of my volumes are on that folio database. Many hundreds of other books are there available. And the good thing is that in one disc you can search. It revolutionized the way that we dealt with Prabhupada's books and material. You could sit at a computer and search every single book in a couple of seconds and find out what you want. I mean, an amazing utility. I don't know how many of you have got, you know, the Prabhupada Vedabase, the folio Vedabase. If you don't have it, you don't know what you're missing. It's an amazing preaching tool. So, then added to that, all the rest of the BTGs, because the previous edition was just up to 1960. So then they did a thing, they combined all the years of BTG, that's also on the folio, from 1944 to 2004. And that's all there, that's available on the folio program. So that's the computerization. So let's look and see what's in the archive. That's just a description of, you know, the products that have come from it. Now you can see here five elements. On the top, on the top left, the East Village Other, Save Earth Now. That's a famous poster. In the middle, there's a pair of hands with a slide. On the right-hand side, there's a handwritten document on the top. On the bottom left, there's a real tape recorder and some cassettes. And on the bottom right, there's a typed-up letter with Prabhupada's signature on it. So we'll look at those different five elements. 2,200 hours of audio recordings from 1966 to 1977. That cassette tape that you see there, I believe that's my handwriting on that. Before that, we were using reel-to-reel. Then in June of 76, we switched over to cassettes. It was a lot more convenient for recording. 2,200 hours of recordings. This is really interesting. 11,000 original documents from Prabhupada. If you can read that, what it says is news and views from the Soviet Union. So what Prabhupada was doing in Calcutta or Delhi, wherever he was so hard up, he couldn't buy paper. So he would get the free, you know, newsletters from the Soviet Union, from the Soviet embassy. And on the back side, which is what you see on the right-hand side there, he's writing, you know, his, you know, theology. So on the one side you've got the biggest atheistic propaganda in the world, and on the and on the back side you've got Srila Prabhupada writing the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. It's very interesting. Prabhupada was a complete utilitarian. Didn't waste anything. Then there's 7,000 letters. There's about 6,000 from Srila Prabhupada, and there's about 1,000 that were written to him. So they're all there in the archives. Prabhupada was a prolific letter writer. And then about 200 miscellaneous items, like this original cover from the East Village Other. This is the famous photograph when Prabhupada went for the very first time to preach in public, do kirtan. We were just discussing that. Somebody was there. They took that photograph. They reported that whole event. So that's Prabhupada there preaching to the crowd in Tompkins Square Park. Then the other aspect, the slides, 130,000 images. Out of those, about 32,000 are directly of Srila Prabhupada. There's a few thousand of temples and, you know, holy places. There's about 70,000 from ISKCON up until 1977 during Prabhupada's time. So, you know, anything and everything, ISKCON activities, its early days. 130,000 images. So that's the contents of the archive. Now, what are they doing with it? Again, you see some images here, 6 different images. We'll look at those different images. That will tell us exactly what activities are going on in the archives. Here you'll see somebody sitting at a computer there. That's Paramarupa Prabhu. There's in the middle section some typing there. And on the right-hand side, he's got some special spray that he's treating some photographs or slides with. So what they're doing there is they're transferring all the materials to archival, uncompressed digital format. If you know anything about digitization, when you compress an original digital recording, if you compress it down, most formats, the quality deteriorates. You lose a lot of the quality. If you keep the audio in wave format, though, you can make unlimited copies. They're all the same. There's no deterioration in the quality. So that's archival. You keep it in the original format or in that format. Similarly with the slides and images, TIFF. Yeah. Again, if you make an original slide into a JPEG or other format, it deteriorates. You know, the quality's not as good. If it goes to TIFF, you don't lose anything. The color, everything remains exactly the same. So that's one thing that they're doing. Everything has to be archived in these two formats, audio and digital and images. And then the effort to conserve and preserve original documents. On the left there, you can see a document with there's a kind of a contraption. What they're doing there is spraying it with, I think it's magnesium oxide. It strips out all the acid out of the paper. Because acid in the paper, in the chemicals in the paper, means after a few years it goes yellow. If you leave it long enough, there'll be nothing left. So deacidification, every single document, that 11,000 documents, every one of them has to be treated like this. In the middle, there's a computer screen with a lot of little lines on it. Cataloging. There's no point in having 130,000 images if you can't find anything. So 40, you know, all of that huge amount of material, 11,000 documents, all the recordings, all the 130,000 slides, every single one has to be identified and cataloged. Huge endeavor to do that. And then once they've done that, on the right you'll see there some cabinets. They're all fireproof cabinets. Yeah, again, you know, if you have some disaster, you want to make sure that your documents and everything are safe. Now, apart from putting them in there, the archives also have some original materials in a place called Iron Mountain. It's interestingly enough, I think it's like 60 meters down underground, or 600 feet, something like that. It's an archive place, underground. And it's just near Butler, Pennsylvania. Butler, Pennsylvania is where everything started. That's where Prabhupada went to first. And that's where the archive is. So, kind of ironic there. All right, so now, with all that stuff, there's the maintenance of all that material, there's the preservation of it, then there's things that they do with that. So one of the things is, writers like myself, we access the archives, we get transcripts, recordings. You know, I need that material for when I'm writing my books. Other devotees also do the same thing. Authenticity and certification for legal issues. In 1978, Srila Prabhupada's eldest son, M.M. Day, sued in the courts to take over the whole of ISKCON because he said, I am his eldest son, I inherit ISKCON after Prabhupada's death. So he tried to prove many things in order to establish his claim. One of the things that he had to say was that Prabhupada was not really a sannyasi. Yeah, that he didn't really take sannyas, because a sannyasi, by law in India, has no heirs. So that was a problem for him. If he wanted to claim his inheritance, he had to prove that Prabhupada wasn't actually a sannyasi. You can imagine where he was at. He produced a number of documents which he claimed Prabhupada had written and he had signed. But we were able, by research and reference back to the originals, we were able to show that he had actually changed them. And in some, he had faked the documents completely. So that's just one. I mean, that was the year after Prabhupada left. But what to speak about the future when some people have their own ideas they want to establish and they want to claim authenticity. So we have to be very careful. So it's very important that we preserve Prabhupada's stuff so that nobody can cheat people in the future. So we provide that certification. We also provide images for BBT International. If anybody wants to, use any of the images, like the BBT paintings, let's say, then they have to get permission from the archives, sign a document, etc. You can custom order any image that you want. If you have access, if you like something, you can write to them and, they'll supply it. And also, they provide all the stuff for the Veda base, all the materials that are going in there. So now, that's the activities. Let's look at the plans that they have. They have a short-term goal, which is to complete the transferring and conversion of the audio. There's still 1,200 hours of audio. We think we've got it all. We haven't. There's 1,200 hours of audio recordings that have still not been published yet. They're still working on that. Documents. There's several thousand documents that have still not been deacidified. There's manuscripts. There's letters. There's published books that the BBT are coming out with every year, just like the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. That has to go into the folio. There's transparencies. There's negatives. And all of that has to be digitized. Huge job. So that's going on. We have to maintain the archival facilities and the preventative maintenance operation. So what to speak about doing anything new, just to keep everything as it is, to keep it safe and secure. Temperature control, the working environment, security, safe storage, etc., preservation. That's all going on. So that's short term, just keep things running. Midterm, we want to conserve and preserve. We want to complete the cataloging. As everything comes in, this is a huge endeavor. Keep that going. A meta-catalog is a gigantic database of all the other smaller databases. And then we want to keep on upgrading the Veda base. Anybody that's familiar with computers, you'll know that, something from 5 years or 10 years ago, it's practically unusable. Software is being upgraded every year, 2 years, 3 years. We're already in a situation where the original folio program that child could be given something to eat or drink or something. Yeah. the Folio program that we bought in 95 or 94, that company, Folio, they no longer support that version that we're still using. They've upgraded several times, and we haven't, because we haven't been able to afford, you know, to keep a technician that can keep on doing the upgrades. And then what to speak about, you know, the Windows platform, it's getting upgraded. So after 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, you're in a position where your entire archival database is useless because you don't have the computer programs to read it anymore. So you need to, just from that point of view, you need to keep upgrading. And then what to speak about, you know, when there's new material coming out and adding to that. So that's very important. Then we have to train new staff. You know, all us old guys, we're all starting to, as they say, drop like flies. you know, another 20 years' time, there's not going to be any Prabhupada disciples around practically. And, you know, all this work then needs to be passed on. We need to train people how to take it on, learn how to do it, and push it forward also. Maintain it, but push it forward. So that's the midterm goals. And then the long-term goal, we want to secure endowments. In India, everybody knows this principle. Many temples, that's how they secure the longevity of the puja, Seva Puja, by collecting endowments. And then that ensures some regular income so that in the future the Seva will go on. So in the same way, we'd like to do something like that for the archives. We would also like to move out of the converted house that we're in and custom build a proper archive facility. It would serve two purposes, along the lines of a United States presidential library. Prabhupada deserves that. He's more important than any president in America. He deserves this, and we should provide it for him. Now, that will do two things. The operations of the archives will continue, conserve, preserve, but also it will provide public access. People can come and learn about Srila Prabhupada, who that personality was. People will want to know that in the future. And so here's a couple of examples. This is the Lyndon Baines Johnson, all the way with LBJ, as that was his slogan in the early 60s. He was the man that bombed the heck out of Vietnam. This is his archive. That's the building at the top. The red picture at the bottom, there's millions of documents in there. Those are the archival files. They're in a humidity-free and steady temperature environment. There's millions of documents in there that people can research. And then the other one is Ronald Reagan. This is in California. They did an interesting thing. They built a replica of the White House, the main room there, in his museum. So when you go around, you can get a sense of, you know, what this man was doing, where he was living, how he was working as the president. So there's all kinds of things you can do with these kinds of libraries. We'd like to do something for Prabhupada like that. So, why should we preserve all this material, if it's not already obvious? In Prabhupada's own words, "I wish that it will be noted down in history that this Krishna consciousness movement is responsible for saving the world. Practically, our movement is the only hope for saving the world from complete disaster." That was Bombay, January the 1st, 1972. Yeah, right here in Bombay. That was a letter that Prabhupada wrote. And I was with Prabhupada in 1977 on the train from Allahabad on January the 18th, going to Calcutta. Rameshwara was his secretary. Prabhupada told us that in the future, historians will note this period, how the Krishna consciousness movement saved the world. a week later we were in Bhubaneswar. Rameshwaras were relating that comment that Prabhupada made to some sannyasis that were there. So he says, Prabhupada said this past week that in the future, historians will study this period of world history, how this movement changed the world. He said in the future, they will just note this period, how the world is being changed. And Prabhupada says, yes, a new renaissance. So if we don't have all the original documents, how will historians understand that? Yeah. Prabhupada will just become a mythological figure. We have to preserve everything that's connected with Prabhupada. Very important. And here's another reason. Anchalila 14:8 verse. In those days, Swarup Damodara and Raghunath Das Goswami lived with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, whereas all other commentators lived far away from him. So the main source material for the Chaitanya Charitamrita, of course, was these diaries that were being kept by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's main followers. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada says, besides Swarup Damodar and Raghunath Das Goswami, there were many others who also recorded Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur believes that the people of the world would benefit greatly if such notes were available. It is a most unfortunate situation for human society that none of these notebooks is still extant. Just that, you know, Chaitanya Bhagwat, Chaitanya Charitamrita, a couple of other small tracks, but that's it. But Prabhupada says there were actually many, many people that wrote, but where is it all now? It's all gone. So this is our responsibility. There's never been a time in human history in this Kali Yuga where such an opportunity to record and preserve the teachings of any acharya, it's never occurred like this before. We have not one single recording of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada's guru. We don't know, we've never heard the sound of his voice. But we have 200 hours of Prabhupada's audio recordings. And how much we will be condemned if we don't preserve that. Yeah? That we will never be forgiven. So we have to do this. What to speak about everything else. So, we'll always have a place where you can see and hear as it is, the preserved original, the holy relics that the Acharya has touched and toiled over. We'll have the ability to trace back any item to its original. Now, this is that provenance or chain of custody. Yeah, proof of provenance is provided by the operation of control systems that document the history of records that are kept in an archive. In other words, when any copy is made, it's noted down that this is linked to the original. Then when it's passed around, you can trace back that chain of custody and be assured that what you're seeing is an accurate representation of the original. Very, very important. And that way you can distinguish the authentic from the fakes. And another reason to provide legal certified documents in support of Prabhupada, ISKCON, the BBT and the worldwide movement. We've got court cases going on right now in America where some people are falsely trying to take over one of Prabhupada's temples. And one of our defenses is to show, you know, the original documents of, you know, creation of the GBC or whatever it is. That's from the archives. We want to illuminate to history who Srila Prabhupada was and what he did, and provide the time, place, and circumstances of Srila Prabhupada within the parampara. Jayapataka Maharaj was just telling me that he visited a library in Melkote, where I think the Sri Vaishnavs are there. They have a huge library, and they have all hundreds of original palm leaf manuscripts and documents going back hundreds and hundreds of years. They have scholars there, very carefully copying them, preserving them, scanning them, researching them. We should be doing this. We have to do this for our line, our parampara system. I don't know whether there's such a place in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition as yet, where we have a central library where all of these things are available. We must preserve Srila Prabhupada's. We want to ensure there'll be no question in the future about what Prabhupada really said. And the question here is, do we know what Jesus really said? Or that he even existed? There are some people now that say he was just a mythological figure that was invented. 2,000 years now, it's gone. So we want to be able to trace back more than 2,000 years. At least Prabhupada said this movement will be extant for 10,000 years. I heard him say that. But it won't be if we don't preserve the materials. So, generations will come to know because we are taking the time, in the future will come to know because we're taking the time to preserve this material now. So, why are we making this presentation? Just to recap, we've looked at what is an archive, a brief history of it, notable publications, what we're doing now, what services we're providing, the short, mid, and long-term goals. And now, the Bhaktivedanta Archives would like to request your help. I've been making this presentation around a lot of the major temples that I've been visiting during the year. Los Angeles, Alachua, New York, a few other places. The funding for the archives at the present moment has undergone a lot of changes. They were originally, from the materials that they were producing, they were making some money from that, which was enabling them to continue on. Now, because of digitization, a lot of those sales have disappeared. There's a lot of competition for the devotee dollar, as you might put it. There's many other, you know, entities in ISKCON now that are selling so many other books, tapes, recordings, everything. So that income that they've been getting from the sales of their products has reduced very drastically. And also the BBT was providing funds to keep them going, but they've also been cutting back on their funds. For various reasons, the BBT is also experiencing a downturn, at least in the West. In India it's different, but in the West. So the archives is really in a position, as we said, we'd like to establish some kind of endowment fund, which we can keep the corpus in a trust, the principal, and then, you know, the interest can be used for funding the archive activities. So this is an invitation, collectively or individually, if you'd like to play a role in helping to preserve Prabhupada's legacy. This is not a consideration of, you know, one particular temple or one particular program. The archives is the core of ISKCON's activities, Prabhupada's teachings. You know, this is one project that every temple in the world is obliged to. Yeah, it's universal. So if anybody would like to help us, then, whoops, sorry, we're not supposed to show that one. the archives do need help with their finances. I'm going to leave it at that. But if anybody, you know, would like to, I don't know what happened here. Let me see. Okay, I'm just going to flash through those. I deleted all this stuff before. Okay, so we can suggest ways to help. You can give personally, even a little bit. You can allow us or our agents to show this presentation. We're very grateful to the managers here in Chaupati for allowing us to do this. You know, you can show it to individuals in your zone, and we can give you a copy. Or if you know somebody that you think would be interested in supporting this program, then, you know, talk to them. See if they'll be willing to help out. It might be something that they get inspired to do. Or you can introduce, you know, one of the archives representatives to that person, and maybe they can help. whatever. We need help. So in whatever way that you can, your assistance is vital and it's very much appreciated. You can find out more by going to Prabhupada.com. That's easy to remember. Prabhupada.com. That's the website of the archives. And you can make online donations if you want. Or you can correspond with the archives devotees. And they'll let you know how to participate. So with that, we'd like to thank you all very much. You've all been sitting here very patiently for the last 2.5 hours. But I hope that it's helped to increase your consciousness and awareness of Srila Prabhupada. In the early days of ISKCON, actually, I was told when I joined, because it was all about becoming Krishna conscious. Yeah, we read that in Prabhupada's books. Krishna consciousness, that's what, inspired us, becoming Krishna conscious. But then some of the older devotees, they'd tell us, actually, there's two consciousness. There's not just Krishna consciousness, but there's Prabhupada consciousness. So this is our Prabhupada consciousness. The two go together. You can't be Krishna conscious without being Prabhupada conscious. Not possible. So anyway, please, if you feel inspired, see me, see one of the devotees, go on the website, see what you can do to help the archives out, and chant Hare Krishna. Okay, we're going to finish there at this point. I think there's a feast now, is there? Yes. Whatever it is that you do now. So thank you all very, very much. As I said, the seminar will go on tomorrow evening. What time? 7:30 tomorrow evening. We'll continue with the chanting seminar. So thank you all very, very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.